And I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder. One of the four beasts saying, "Come and see," and I saw, and behold, bad movie futures. Hello, bad movie lovers, and welcome to a special preview of Bad Movie Futures, the new members-only series here at Bad Movies We Love. What you're about to hear are the first 15 minutes of the episode on Joker 2 that I recorded with my friend Newman from the Movies for Days podcast. If you like what you hear and you want to become an official card-carrying member of the Resistance, stay tuned at the end of the preview for details on how to do that. I hope you enjoy the preview. Newman, brother, welcome. Welcome back to the show. Welcome to the first time we're going to do Bad Movie Futures here on Bad Movies We Love, a new little sub-series where we tackle some of the quote-unquote, nobody can see the air quotes but you, and some of the movies that are like the worst movie of all time, the worst movie of the year kind of movies, but mostly stuff that is current. So welcome back.
Ahoy and hello. I appreciate that I get to come back on another comic book adjacent flick.
Yeah.
I don't really claim to be a comic book guy, but, you know, when you meet people who are super not a comic book guy, you go, oh, shit. I guess I've been hanging out with the super freaks too long, who all put me to shame. Compared to normal people, I guess I am a comic book guy.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think that's you're a Batman guy as well, which I think is valuable in this discussion because we're going to be talking about Joker. Look, you brought your Batman mug and everything. Again, nobody can see this but me, but you are indeed drinking out of your Batman mug. I just wore black. That's as good as I could do. because like I said, it's been a long morning, and we're talking Joker 2, Folie à Deux, and
Joker 2, Electric Boogaloo.
Yeah, right. So this was a movie that sort of was like instantly considered terrible by such a wide percentage of people, at least in what I've seen, you know, in the way that this movie is discussed online. It has looks like it has an aggregate score of 44, which is in line with where I had it scored for the Bad Movies We Love score of a 43.4, which according to this other source that I'm using, it's called Flickmetrics. It's in the bottom 2% of all movies, but maybe just all movies that are aggregated by this system. So maybe not the bottom 2% of all movies. That seems like impossible.
Realistic.
It doesn't. I mean, if 44 is the watermark for bottom 2%, then I'm curious to see what else is in that bottom 2%. But this had a 48 critic score from Rotten Tomatoes, a 45 Metacritic score, an IMDb of 5.2, a Letterbox of 48, and a Google score of 28. So really just not liked across the board for the most part. And like I saw it and I wasn't like over the moon about it. I wasn't like, oh, my God, I love this movie so much. But of course, the more people were negative about it, the more I wanted to see it.
Yeah, it's interesting because I didn't see this until Christmas break. Mm. And I had seen a lot of negative reactions. I think the most positive reaction I saw was people saying, it seems like what they were trying to do was XYZ. And I kind of respect that. I think that's kind of cool in premise, but it was so fucking boring. I didn't like it. And that was the most positive take I saw when I looked at, like, you know, personal reactions. You know, full disclosure, I didn't look up any or read any official publication critics, you know, anything like that. I just know what the internet told me. The internet said that everybody either hated this movie or thought it was interesting but boring. And so when I went into it, there was all that baggage of, wow, everyone hated this. Let's see what we've got. And so as it rolled along and I wasn't hating it and I was finding it interesting and at times downright beautiful, I was going, what's wrong with this or what's wrong with me? Because, like, this is kind of cool. And the other part of that is that whole aspect of my expectations were colored by the fact that everyone seemed to dislike it. And so I was expecting something very much less good than what I got. And I got to wonder if that's part of why I did, in fact, like this movie quite a bit.
Yeah, I think, you know, whether we go into it with expectations that we make ourselves, whether it's a property that you love and you're just excited for inherently because it's, hey, this is a filmmaker I like and a property that I like, and I'm really excited to see what happens here. Or in this case, I think I probably had a similar experience, is most people were super negative about it. And so while I wasn't in a rush to like jump and see it the first day it came out, I was still curious because I enjoyed the first one, and I was in a different film group before I started ours, and it was announced probably years ago, probably 2020. You know, I think the first Joker was 2019. So when the sequel was first announced, Phillips had said that he was going to make it a musical. And I remember how much backlash that got at that time. And in that movie group that I was in, it was mostly like more of a bro-y film group that was like popular stuff, superhero stuff, action stuff, not so much niche, not so much foreign cinema, not as wide of a swath of ideas and interests as we have in the film group that we have now. And so my take at that time was like, wait a second, you like the first one, you like Todd Phillips as a filmmaker, but then he tells you he wants to like try something new and do something different with the property that you also enjoyed. So like, why not just give him the benefit of the doubt rather than immediately going to like, I heard it was a musical, I'm so upset, it's going to be shit. Like, you're not even giving the film a chance at that point.
Because people feel good when they do that. People like slinging mud. People love tearing shit down just because it's weird or different, or they, you know, it's like Cyclops said in the first episode of X-Men, people fear what they don't understand. And yeah. Also, something else that I've really come to embrace as an ideology, that's not the way I want to phrase that, an idea that came to me or was expressed to me over the last few years that has really come to mean a lot: nothing turns to hate faster than love. When you love something intensely, you have the capacity to feel betrayed by that thing so much more than people who were only passively engaged with it. And, you know, when it comes to these art, I mean, this is like fucking Misery all over again. You've got all these people who are just fanatics about Joker Part 1. And then Todd Phillips says, I'm going to make Part 2 a musical, and they want to strap him down to a bed and slam his fucking legs with a sledgehammer. And it's like, he didn't even make the movie yet, you guys. Would you mellow out? And yeah, so that's what's great about this whole thing is that, and this is part of why I like the movie, there are a few different lenses with which you can look at it, because I think, and tell me if you agree or disagree, I think this is one of those cases, it's a rare case, but it's a thing that happens with sequels sometimes. I'll call it the Gremlins 2 effect, where the sequel is not an extension, celebration, or continuation, or just redo of the first one. It's actually turning around and pointing a finger at the first one and being very critical of the first one and making some deliberately different choices to subvert the feelings of everybody that loved and enjoyed that first one. Now, sometimes you get a Gremlins 2. I actually don't know what the initial reaction from audiences about Gremlins 2 was. I know that now it's lauded and loved by like the horror community and folks, but I honestly don't know when it came out if people were like, "Ugh, what is this? Fuck your new batch. What? Ew." I don't know. But it feels like that's what Joker 2 is doing, but it's still so tragic, and everything that isn't a big musical fantasy is really kind of just sad and miserable and gets into that droning, you know, kind of place that we kind of lived in the first one. And so at the risk of sounding silly, it's less fun than Gremlins 2. So I don't think it's as successful, but again, I really like it. And that's just one lens to look at this thing through, you know?
Yeah, and like, I don't think the intent of Joker is to be fun. I think some of the intent in making the film is to have fun making it, and I think you can see that, but I agree with what you said, spot on, because I look at Joker 2 as the other side of the coin of Joker 1. Like, they're two halves of the same whole, and it's essential that I think artistically they are maybe viewed as one thing, because like where Joker 1 ends is like he is at the top, he has ascended, he has become the Joker at that point, is for all intents and purposes, right? And then where 2 starts, it's nothing but a downhill trajectory from that moment. So it is this like this pendulum that we're on. And I like that you mentioned that this movie sort of looks back at the first one and sort of like doesn't necessarily like make fun of it, but it takes its shots at the first movie and what the first movie was doing. And at the very end of the movie, I was like, I'm curious if this is Phillips like talking to the audience in terms of how he's toying with the idea of Arthur being the Joker, because like Harley is a character that is a Batman story character, like Gotham, like this is set in that world. But all of the ideas of like him being the Joker that we basically know and are accustomed to is really what's in flux. And then we get that last moment between him and Harley on the stairs, and her final song is, you know, that's entertainment, baby. And she tells him, you know, the only thing we had was the fantasy and you gave up on that. And so I feel like that's Philip sort of like talking directly to the audience, and that in the first movie, there is sort of like this expectation or at least this desire from the audience to want him to be the Joker, for this to be an origin story for the Joker, because we hadn't seen that before. And so that one sort of like swells up into that direction and ends at that plateau. And it's like, okay, maybe he is the Joker. And then in this, we see like all of like the reality behind what's actually going on here. That's why I feel like it has to be sort of viewed as two halves of the same whole, as in like a artistic experience.
Yeah. It's interesting to me the ways in which, cause I watched them back to back to prepare for our discussion today.
Well, good. Cause I didn't, I rewatch the second one.
You know, what I found in doing that was all of these similarities between the two that I really hadn't appreciated or clocked when I just watched the second one for the first time back in December. Arthur is consistently retreating into fantasy, and he does it over and over again throughout both movies. It's just that in the second one, he kind of has, and so much of his fantasy and how he relates to the world and engages in the world with any positivity or joy is through music. He always says it's through comedy, but in reality, when we see him actually doing it well, it's through music. And so in an interesting way, in the second one, it's almost like his fantasy or his need to retreat into fantasy becomes even more courageous and more bombastic, possibly to counterpoint how much realism he's being forced to deal with. Because that's the other thing that we see in a lot of these courtroom scenes, especially when Zazie Beetz comes to testify and Mr. Puddles comes to testify. Mm-hmm. We actually see the real world results and reactions, not just specifically what he did, but also the ways in which the world started reacting to the victims of his crimes, the people that were like in the periphery, who got caught up in his madness that he never even thought about. And he said to himself, well, I didn't physically do anything awful to those people, therefore I didn't harm them at all. And that's a point where the story in the movie is forcing him and us to deal with the fact that, no, it's not actually that cut and dry. And so it's like, to counter that, we've got to have even bigger bombast, even bigger musical garish design to it. It's interesting. Every time this movie was about to lose me, it got me back by doing something just visually gorgeous. Lady Gaga was the perfect person to play this exact iteration of Harley Quinn. Like, this exact iteration of Harley Quinn will never exist again and has never existed. But Lady Gaga is perfect for what this movie needed. She's got the perfect voice for these kinds of songs. That sequence where they've got the projector playing and the piano is on fire on one side of the screen, but the blue light from the projector's on the other side of the screen, and the two of them in the middle having a moment about to kiss. Get Scorsese in here, because that's cinema. And it was shit like that throughout the whole movie.
Thank you for checking out this preview episode of Bad Movie Futures. We're going to be starting with 2024 films, and the goal is to do at least one of these per month, but there are always new movies in the worst of the year crosshairs. So if the shoe fits, I'm happy to wear it. You can sign up for the members-only tier by clicking on the link in the show notes or going to badmovieswelove.captivate.fm/support. I hope to see you soon.